From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I'm a gardener, someone who loves showy plants in artful arrangements. But in recent years, I've been looking less with a collector's eye when shopping and more from the point of view of an insect. Yes, really. That means more and more I'm layering in native plants to my landscape, but which ones among the ones tagged native do the very best job of creating effective wildlife interactions and habitat? That's our subject today, but first this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
You've probably heard the word nativar, as in a cultivar of a native plant, but what does it mean and how effective are these often showier cultivated varieties at supporting wildlife? I invited Doug Tallamy, professor of entomology at University of Delaware and author of Bringing Nature Home and also The Living Landscape, back to the program today to help me understand more about this important subject. Welcome, Doug Tallamy. Thank you for making time for us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yeah, I was thinking of you yesterday as I was mowing, dare I use the M word, mowing the increasingly smaller areas I do mow anymore, partly thanks to you, and noticing some spots that I've unmown since our last conversation now are the nurseries for seedling oaks, something like what I remember happened to you. Isn't that amazing what happens?
It's not all that amazing. If we leave it alone, plants do come in.
But they do, they do. So I don't even kind of know where to begin, but tell us, nativars, where should we begin? Should we begin with definitions or
sure, that's a good
smart
place.
Okay.
You know, that is the most common question I get is are cultivars of native plants, and people just call them nativars. Although I have learned the horticultural trade does not like that term, so.
Oops, too bad.
But are they as good in terms of performing their ecological functions as the straight species from which they were derived?
Right.
And it's a good question because when you go to the nursery, most of the time that's what's for sale. It's some genetic variant of a straight species.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are lots of reasons that cultivars are created. Most of them do focus on aesthetics. But any genetic variant that is disease resistant is also a cultivar.
Right.
Let's make sure we're not talking about hybrids. Hybrids are the cross between two different species.
Right.
Which is, you know, they're offered as well, but it's not officially a cultivar.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we just finished a study looking at six common cultivar traits in native plants and seeing how they might have impacted insect use of that plant. Now, these are all woody plants, so we did not look at flowering. We didn't look at flowers at all. So we didn't look at the impact on pollinators. Other people are doing that. But just in terms of how well leaves support caterpillars and other things that drive food webs, we looked at what happens when you make a green leaf red or purple. Oh. What happens when you change that leaf into a variegated form? What happens when you take a tall plant and make it short or change the habit in some way? When you enhance fall color, when you increase fruit size?
Huh.
What was the other trait? I think that's it. There were six traits.
Uh-huh.
And the only thing that consistently deterred insect feeding was taking a green leaf and making it red or purple.
I knew you were going to say that, and that makes me sad, but okay.
Yeah. and it makes sense because that's
of
changing
course.
The leaf chemistry.
The chemistry. And chlorophyll tastes different from, what, the anthocyanin pigments or something?
That's right. Anthocyanins are feeding deterrents.
Yeah.
So when you load a leaf with feeding deterrents, of course, it deters feeding. And, you know, that is something that gardeners have been seeking for a long time. They don't want any insects in their garden.
Mm-hmm.
And if our gardens just occupied a little space on this planet, that'd be okay. But they don't. They occupy a huge area. It's not just our gardens, all the landscapes around us. So not only do we bring in cultivars of native plants, we bring in non-native plants
Yes.
that are also very poor at supporting insects. And then a lot of those escape. What is it? 85% of our woody invasive plants are from our gardens. And they're, you know, there's very few habitats that aren't just choked with plants from Asia.
Yeah.
So we've converted an awful lot of our land into a landscape with non-native plants that are not supporting the food webs that everything else needs.
Right. So in my area, I'm in the Northeast. I'm in New York State, sort of on the border of Mass and Connecticut. And, you know, I might see, I guess you would call it maybe is the common name the red osier dogwood, the Cornus cerisea? Mm-hmm. Is that mm-hmm. what it is? Yeah. And I might see that, I think. And then I might have one in my garden, like Cornus silver and gold, Cornus cerisea silver and gold, which I first met that plant at the home of Dick Leidy at Mount Cuba Center.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
And he had just introduced it or was just getting ready to introduce it a long time ago. And so all these years I've been enjoying that plant, and I love the pollinators who come to the white flowers, and I love the white fruits later. And as a gardener, I like the variegated foliage and the gold twigs and so forth. I love when the birds, especially thrush relatives, come and devour all that fruit when it's ready in the summer. But am I not doing a good job? Do you know what I mean? Like, should I be casting it out, or what happens here?
No. First of all, there's room for compromise here.
Okay.
We shouldn't look at single plants. We should look at our entire landscape as a unit.
Okay.
And say, is our landscape doing the basic things that we all need to do on any privately owned property? We all have to support food webs. We all have to sequester carbon. We have to have plants that are building their bodies out of carbon and then pumping it into the soil. We all have to have plants that manage our watersheds, and we all have to support pollinators. So every single plant on your property doesn't have to do all of those
okay.
things. And of course, another thing our properties have to do is be pleasing to us. But I contend we can do all of those things. If we choose our plants carefully. So you just named a number of ecological services that your cornice is performing.
Mm-hmm.
The cornice itself, one of the things we've learned recently is that there are big differences between among native plants and how they support food webs. There are really just a few genera that are really good at them. They're making most of the food. Most of the other genera are okay, and some don't make a whole lot of food at all, even though they're all natives. So cornice is it's pretty far down the list there in terms of supplying particularly the insects that drive food webs.
Mm-hmm.
It does help pollinators, and it does make those berries for the birds in the fall. But taking, you know, adding your cornice or taking it out of your landscape isn't going to make a huge difference to the ecological value of your landscape.
Okay.
Adding an oak would
yes.
make a huge difference because
yes.
that is the most powerful plant you can put on your property.
Okay. And how do just as a quick where so I'm I you know where I live and I know where you're located, but wherever anyone is, where can they look to find out what the key plants, is that a keystone plant? Would we call it that?
Or call it that, yes.
Yeah, a keystone plant. Where would someone research to find out if it's oak or if it's whatever it is?
Mm-hmm. Well, we just happen to have made a very convenient website for that.
Oh.
You can go to National Wildlife Federation website and just put in Native Plant Finder.
Okay.
And the ranked list of plants, both woody and herbaceous plants, will pop up for your county, wherever you are in the country. So what used to be a challenge, figuring out which are the best plants, is now easy. Just plug in that zip code and, you know, it's ranked in terms of the ones that support the most caterpillars, which are driving these food webs. So just start at the top of the list and go down, and you'll hit those powerhouses.
Mm, okay, good. Well, and I'll give the link to that with the transcript of the show.
Okay.
The late Elizabeth Farnsworth of New England Wildflower Society, who I admired very much, she said this to me last year: nativars can be the gateway drug to native plants for gardeners. So, in other words, it can help to get us moving towards knowing our knowing natives. Yes.
Yeah. Sure, that I would go along with that. There are two reasons that I wouldn't turn to a cultivar as a first choice.
Okay.
One is most of them are propagated clonally, which means there's zero genetic variability. And in the age of climate change in particular, but we've always needed a lot of genetic variability in our plants. But in the age of climate change, it's particularly important. We've got all these wild swings, and putting plants with no genetic variability out in the environment is just not a good idea.
Okay.
The other thing that bothers me is if the only thing that we sell in nurseries are designed for aesthetics only, it perpetuates the idea that plants are just decorations.
Yes.
And of course, they are decorations and they are beautiful. And we do want beautiful plants in our yard. But we also want to think about those vital functions that they must be performing in our yard. So I would just love to see straight species sold right along with those cultivars. So if the homeowner is more interested in restoration or getting the maximum value out of that particular species, they have the option of buying it. That's
right.
What I would like to see.
Right. So this sort of tension between ornamental and the sort of functional, the two things, instead of a tension, like it's either or, that both should be sold and they both have a place. So maybe right near my front walkway where I have that cornice silver and gold, I might choose the variegated, but in my upper field area and it's a more wild area, I might choose to have an island of the straight one because that's, do you know what I mean? Like,
sure,
mix it up.
Sure.
Yeah.
And, close to the hash, you probably want smaller plants.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of cultivars that are smaller in stature, more compact.
Right.
Those are essentially functional traits that enhance our ability to use those plants in a domestic landscape. That's all fine. And remember, a lot of these cultivars are genetic variants that were simply found in nature. So it was nature that selected them. It wasn't humans.
Right.
So bringing them in and planting them and putting a name on them doesn't automatically make them bad. They're fine plants when they're collected that way.
Mm-hmm. So you've mentioned the food web and so forth, and we just mentioned sort of straight species. And so this is a story then, it's a food web, in other words, in my layperson's version, I always tell people when I'm lecturing or doing workshops in my garden, we got to grow more bugs, we got to grow more bugs. Everything survives because of plants and then because of bugs. That's my version of science. But
that's a very accurate version.
Fairly accurate, right? And that's a little theatrical, and that works in a workshop environment. Everybody starts laughing. But at any rate, so we're trying to grow more insects, and those are feeding lots of other creatures and up and up and up this food chain. Those insects, beneficials, native insects and other animals, and the straight species of these plants, these not nativars and especially not hybrids, these straight wild types of these plants, they have a coevolution story, right? They've been around together a long time. And is that why there's this importance that you're talking about, why their maroon leaves are not as good as the plain green one that nature made?
Exactly.
Okay.
Plants, native or not, don't want to be eaten by insects. So they protect themselves chemically. They load their leaves with nasty tasting compounds. We call them secondary metabolic compounds that make the leaf either bitter or in many cases downright toxic. So in order to eat these plants, insects have developed adaptations that allow them to get around those defenses.
Right.
There are particular enzymes that can detoxify the compounds or store or excrete them. There are behavioral adaptations that allow them to minimize their exposure to the compounds and life history adaptations that do the same thing. But an insect can't develop adaptations to all the compounds that are out there, because there are many thousands. So what they do is they focus on one plant lineage that's using one particular type of compound, and they get good at getting around that one. And I always use the monarch butterfly as an example.
Of course, yes.
Because, it is a specialist on milkweed. Now, it chose a tough genus to specialize on because milkweeds are very well protected with compounds called cardiac glycosides and also that milky latex sap. And most insects cannot eat milkweeds. But monarchs have gotten good at detoxifying the cardiac glycosides and also avoiding this sticky latex sap by they they chew through the midrib of the leaf, and that blocks the flow of this sap down to where they're eating.
Clever.
But in developing all those adaptations, they have not spent any time developing adaptations to get around the tannins that are in oaks, or the cucurbitaceans in cucurbits, or the nicotine in tobacco, or the cyanide in cherry, and on. All plants have compounds. And if they don't have the adaptation to get around them, the insect can't eat it. So they find their host plant by chemistry. It smells right. It tastes right. And if we change that leaf chemistry, they probably don't recognize it, or they're unable, they don't have the adaptations to be able to deal with that chemical change. Mm. And for the same reason, when we bring in a plant from Asia, if we put ginkgo in our yard, our insects don't have a clue how to eat ginkgo. They don't have any of the adaptations that allow them to process that food material.
Ian, a paper you sent me to read, which was very interesting, a recent paper that you did, I think you cite the fact that 90% of insect herbivores are diet specialists. Is that right?
That's right.
Do I have that number right?
That's right.
So they have a specific, like what you just said about the monarch, they have a specific relationship with the plant. They're not generalists feeding on any old thing, huh?
Right. Now, 10% are generalists, mm-hmm. and we say, well, they can eat anything, but that's not at all true.
Right.
It just means they can eat several things.
Okay.
But if you look at the range, if I think of the number of plant genera in my yard, I don't know how many it is, but it's got to be close to 1,000. Mm-hmm. And I look at the most generalized insects. Actually, I've got the white-marked tussock moth in my yard. It's the most generalized insect in the whole country, and it eats 110 genera of plants.
Oh.
But that leaves 900 genera that it can't eat. So even the generalists are fairly focused compared to what is available out there.
Okay.
And often they are regionally even more focused. So Luna moths, for example, can eat, I think it's 25 genera of plants. But if I take a Luna moth from the eastern shore of Maryland, where it's all sweet gum, that's their host plant there, and feed them a host plant that's listed in the literature, like it's listed that they eat oaks, they die there because they're specialized on sweet gum in that one region of the country, even though they're considered a generalist.
There's so much
we have to be careful
learn.
With that generalized term. Most insects are really focused on particular lineages.
Okay. In a recent conversation with George Coombs at Mount Cuba Center, who does the trial gardens there, you've done some collaboration, University of Delaware and Mount Cuba Center, I believe, recently. And he was talking about he was telling me about his report, the results of their phlox trials, and you know, it was. The idea that sort of bigger isn't better, this goes back to the sort of hand of plant breeders and things and making things for the garden eye-catching appeal. So we've made phlox flowers bigger in certain colors and shapes and whatever, the flower heads. And it turned out that the biggest ones weren't necessarily the best for if you're a butterfly, right? So that's another kind of an example of...
That's right. That's right. I should mention that it was Mount Cuba Center that funded our study of cultivars. So we want to.
Oh, that's fantastic. See, now I didn't understand that as much as I know them and talk to them regularly, I didn't know that was the relationship specifically, but wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah. And actually we had an undergraduate defend her senior thesis yesterday, and George Coombs was there.
Uh-huh.
Where again, Mount Cuba supported her study looking at hydrangea cultivars.
Oh.
Particularly focus on hydrangea arborescens and the very common cultivar that you get. If you go to the store
Annabelle.
And ask for arborescens, they give you hydrangea arborescens Annabelle.
Sure.
Because it's they've changed the lace cap flower into a mop head flower.
Yes.
That is loaded with sterile bracts, and that's what the big mop head is. It's all these white bracts. So no surprise. What the student did was set up video cameras and look at the flower visitors that came into the flowers, and Annabelle was at the bottom of the list.
Yeah.
Because first of all, it has far fewer fertile flowers, and even the fertile flowers it does have are very low in nectar. The nectar quality is very poor. So we've changed it. It's prettier for us, but you've taken a native plant, which actually it's a really great pollinator plant. When it's the straight species, and we've created a cultivar that's almost useless to pollinators, and that's what people have to realize. what has the cultivar change actually done to your particular plant? And there's no one answer to that. You know, it always, the answer is it depends.
Yeah.
But, If you've got a double flower, those are all sterile. If you have anything that's really, really showy, be suspicious that energy has gone into enlarging the bracts or changing the color, and it takes energy away from pollen and nectar production. And if you're planting this plant for pollinators, you do need to know that.
Yeah. So in the last 3-4 minutes, I want to ask Justin, and I'm going to, as I said, give the link to that great plant sort of reference website that you mentioned that helps us get to the right ones for our area. But what is your general guidance for me then as a gardener? So whether I have an established garden or empty beds, you know, what would you like me to do? What does Doug Tallamy want me to do? What kind of sort of, what should I have in mind when I'm going out shopping, you know?
Well, you know, if you are the average gardener, I would ask you to consider reducing the area you have in your property that's in lawn.
Yes.
Because out of those things I listed, lawn isn't accomplishing any of those.
Zero.
And yes. Get, you know, so take the area that you take out of lawn, put more plants into your yard.
Okay.
And think about the role of those plants. You want to have those really productive plants making all those caterpillars so that birds have enough food to reproduce.
Yes.
But you also want to, you want to support those pollinators. And those are usually different plants. Pollinators require plants that are blooming throughout the season, not a single plant. You want a sequence of plants that are blooming so that you can support a sequence of pollinators. You know, keep in mind, we're not just talking about the honeybee here. We're talking about 4,000 species of native bees, almost all of which are in decline right now because we have these sterile landscapes that aren't producing the flowers that they need. And also keep in mind, a lot of these pollinators are specialists just like the herbivores are.
Yes.
So there are plants like goldenrod and native willows and sunflowers and asters. Those are the top ones that support specialized pollinators. And just those, that's four genera I named, support over 40 species of specialized pollinators. So if you can have room in your garden for those four species, you've just helped an awful lot of pollinators. And the generalist pollinators go to them too. So you've done a good thing.
Okay. So caterpillars, we're going to support them. A sequence of offerings through the season for pollinators. Mm-hmm. I do think willows are just underutilized, and I've been adding more of them, more native willows, like even at fringe areas, you know, like along the roadside, and I'm in a rural area.
Right.
You know,
right.
It just,
right.
As opposed to some other kind of quote-unquote hedge, I've been using more willows, and, you know, it's a place that I wasn't otherwise cultivating, and boy, oh boy, it's a buzz when those things are flowering or, you know,
I was just in St. Louis, and there's a place called Shaw Nature Reserve that is experimenting with prairie willows, making hedges out of those, where they only get 3 or 4 feet tall.
Yeah.
And they're blooming all at the same time, and they don't need to be in the wet. As a matter of fact, they like it dry. So that, you know, that'll be a great landscape plant that'll support those early season pollinators. Early season is a tough time for pollinators. They need flowering plants right away, and willow's one of the best.
Well, Doug Tallamy, I always learn so much when we speak, and of course from your books, and I'm so appreciative of your, like I said at the beginning, of your making the time to talk again. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Okay.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Thanks to all of you for tuning in, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. Find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or facebook.com/awaytogarden or even on Instagram/awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.